Welcome to Learning English, a 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. On today's program, Anne Ball tells us about the challenges of getting humans to Mars. Katie Weaver brings us a story about civics education in America. And Kelly Jean Kelly presents Episode 8 of America's Presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
Too often, young Somali Americans have made news for all the wrong reasons. Some young people have fallen victim to drug abuse or the appeal of gang violence. Others have turned to extremist ideology. But youth organizations in the American state of Minnesota are trying to change that. Somali groups there have taken steps to keep young people away from bad influences. One such effort was a basketball tournament for Somali Americans living in and around the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The competition was the idea of 12 youth organizations representing Islamic centers. It gives the players a chance to build up their basketball skills and gain self-esteem. Minnesota is home to 20,000 Somalis, more than in any other state. More than 80,000 Somalis live in the United States. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation says about 12 people have joined militant groups in Syria in recent years. The FBI adds that more than 20 men have joined al-Shabaab militants in Somalia since 2007. Beza Tesfe is the Conflict and Governance Research Manager for the aid agency Mercy Corps. She has done research in Somalia, Somaliland, and Puntland on why young people join extremist groups. Tesfe found that, unlike what many believe, it is not poverty or unemployment that are the main reasons Somalis join extremist groups. Instead, the strongest influences are young people who feel their interests are being ignored, especially in political decisions. They also feel discriminated against based on their tribe or ethnic group. Tesfe said it is important to give young Somali Americans chances to do something meaningful in their communities. This included activities like volunteering, doing awareness campaigns around salient issues that young kids cared about, she said. Tesfe said that a combination of civil involvement and civil society reduced the number of Somali youth taking part in extremist and political violence. The key takeaway is that civic engagement and civil society is a real need if we are trying to address the root causes of violence, and we have evidence to support that, she said. Programs like the basketball tournament are designed to provide activities to help young Somali Americans stay away from negative influences. The organization For Youth by the Youth created the tournament. Yusuf Mohammed leads the group.
The reason we started this program was when we saw what the youth are going through and how they were involved with gang fights among themselves. When we saw how they are suspected or labeled as extremists, we started to bring them together in order to prevent them from getting involved with drugs. We found a place where they can stay fit and stay busy and avoid negative influences.
One of the basketball players, Abdullahi Bare, agrees that sports can help young people like him.
This kind of tournament brings us together as brothers. We came together and we finished the games. We eat together and communicate as well.
I'm John Russell.
Human exploration of Mars is now an official goal of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Last month, U.S. President Donald Trump signed a bill to increase NASA's budget. The law sets spending at $19.5 billion for the 12-month period starting on October 1, 2017. Congress will need to approve the money. And for the first time, the NASA budget adds human exploration of Mars as an official goal for the agency. The president spoke at the signing ceremony. Trump said he was happy to sign the spending plan into law. He added that for almost 60 years, NASA has inspired millions of Americans to imagine distant worlds and a better future on Earth.
It's been a long time since a bill like this has been signed, reaffirming our national commitment to the core mission of NASA: human space exploration, space science, and technology.
Sending astronauts to Mars is the next great test for NASA. Space agency officials hope to have people on Mars by the 2030s. The agency is expected to develop new technology to carry out the mission by working with private companies. SpaceX, owned by businessman Elon Musk, is working on its own plan to get to Mars. His company plans to launch an unmanned spaceship to the Red Planet as soon as 2018. When sending anyone into deep space, one of the biggest problems is how to deal with damaging radiation. The spacecraft has to be built with materials that protect against the effects of radiation. But more work is needed. Scientists are working on ways to protect astronauts from the radiation they will face while traveling outside Earth's atmosphere. The atmosphere and Earth's magnetic fields protect us from the damaging and possibly deadly effects of cosmic and gamma rays from our sun and outer space. High levels of radiation can lead to cancer and sometimes death. If there were a nuclear disaster here on Earth, it would take several meters of lead or thick concrete to keep us safe from the radiation. The same is true for astronauts in space. The thin atmospheres of the Moon and Mars will not provide protection for the people who might travel or live there. So, shielding human beings from radiation is a critical part of colonizing space. Scientists are working on several methods of protection. One involves a vest to be worn by astronauts. Called the AstroRad radiation shield, it is a product of an Israeli company called STEMRAD. Gideon Waterman is STEMRAD's chief technology officer.
From the worst case of a nuclear disaster to the best case of humans walking on Mars, we're providing the best possible radiation protection.
The vest is designed to protect vital human tissue, like reproductive organs and lungs, from radiation. It will also protect stem cells. These are simple cells in the body that are able to develop into different kinds of cells, such as blood cells, cells for making skin, or other body parts. The vest may get its first test in space in 2018. It may travel into space when NASA's Orion spacecraft makes its first test trip around the moon. STEMRAD says it will provide the same protection as a shielded safe room traveling on the Orion. Oren Milstein is the company's CEO and chief scientific officer.
Based on our simulations, we're sure it works, but, you know, to be 100% sure, we're setting this up on EM-1, which is NASA's next launch of the Orion space capsule.
The vest is lightweight. It is made of many small cells. These cells are grouped together, so the device looks almost like a honeycomb made by a bee. Every vest will be made individually for each astronaut. NASA is also exploring other ways for dealing with the radiation. One idea is building a storm shelter deep inside the floor of the Orion spacecraft. Astronauts would hide there in the event of a solar flare storm. Solar flares are sudden bursts of energy from a small area of the sun's surface. The space agency is also working on developing drugs like antioxidants to fight the effects of radiation. This medicine could be taken to reverse some of the effects of severe radiation exposure from solar flares. I'm Anne Ball.
Should American high school students know at least as much about their country's historic documents as immigrants seeking citizenship? Many states and schools are asking that question. People who want to become American citizens must know about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Federalist Papers. These documents were written in the late 1700s by some of the founders of the country. But some experts say American students generally know little about these founding documents. They say if students do not understand the documents, they cannot know how the American system of government operates. So, an increasing number of American schools are requiring students learn about these documents before they can graduate. Individual states are using different methods for teaching the subject. Since 2012, Kentucky, Arkansas, and at least 12 other states put into effect such requirements. Students in those states learn about the founding documents as part of their social studies classes. But lawmakers in other states, including Minnesota, want to give students a greater understanding of the documents. They want schools to teach a separate course about them. Maida Buckley is a retired history and government teacher in Fairbanks, Alaska. Last year, she spoke at a meeting of state legislators studying the issue of civics education. She supports expanded study of the founding documents. Buckley says, when you have a system of government that is based on ideas espoused in the Declaration of Independence and carried out with a working document in the Constitution, those ideas need to be taught. In many states, Republicans and Democrats support the teaching of the documents, although their reasons may differ. Some are concerned about the lack of public involvement in school boards and town halls. Others are worried about the way Republican President Donald Trump and his supporters use their power. Greg Amore is a member of the Rhode Island House of Representatives. He also has taught history classes in high schools for many years. He supports a bill that says the survival of the Republic depends on Americans understanding their country's principles and history. He says, we clearly have seen there is a serious civics deficiency in this country, all the way up to the top, the very top. The Joe Foss Institute is a nonprofit civics education group based in Arizona. It is campaigning to persuade states to pass laws requiring their students to know the answers to the questions on the citizenship test. But some supporters of civics education do not support such laws. Charles Quigley is the executive director of the Center for Civic Education. He says students take too many tests already. Quigley's group developed We the People, a nationwide civics education program. Some teachers at North Smithfield High School in Rhode Island are using the We the People curriculum to teach about the founding documents. The curriculum calls for students to take part in a national competition in which they must defend their ideas. Recently, students debated whether police may search a suspect's smartphone without receiving permission from a judge. They talked about the Constitution's limits on searches, and they discussed the past opinions of Supreme Court justices about searches. Natalie O'Brien is the teacher. She tells her students to think about the more than 200 years of American history and legal thought. Megan Skinner is a 15-year-old student at the school. She says she did not think about politics before she took O'Brien's class. But she says now she uses the founding documents when her family and friends talk about President Trump's administration. It gives us an entirely new perspective on all the events that are going on, Skinner says. I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Van Buren had already been working for the White House for several years. He had been the Secretary of State for President Andrew Jackson and later his vice president. Jackson asked his party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. They agreed, and Van Buren won that election easily. But he did not win the next election, or the next, or the next. In his inaugural speech in 1837, Van Buren noted that he was the first U.S. president to be born after the American Revolution. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His ancestors were Dutch. He remains the only president, so far, who did not speak English as his first language. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren predicted better times for Americans. But several days later, an economic crisis struck. The situation put the country in a depression that lasted for the rest of Van Buren's term. It was one reason the president's opponents called him Martin Van Ruin. The depression was not Van Buren's only problem. He also faced a dispute with Britain related to the border between the U.S. and Canada. The conflict nearly turned into war. Historian Joel Silby says most experts do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Silby notes, Van Buren left an important legacy that still operates today. He created the modern U.S. political system. Van Buren's political education began early. His father was a farmer and operated a hotel at a small town in New York State. Lawmakers sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended farmers who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official, and then a senator, and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with, but she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with four sons. Historian Joel Silby says, although Van Buren did not remarry, he was known as quite charming among the ladies. Van Buren had a gift for politics, that is, developing relationships and forming alliances. Historian Joel Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his work-related life and social activities separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. His ability to make friends became a powerful tool. Before Van Buren, even lawmakers from the same political party operated independently. They had their own beliefs, their own supporters, and their own allies. Van Buren brought them together. First, he identified people who followed the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, support for independent farmers and states' rights. The group had become known as the Democratic Party, although it was in many ways different from the Democratic Party of today. Van Buren organized meetings for Democrats to talk about their political beliefs. he persuaded them to support the same policies, at that time, the policies of Andrew Jackson. Sometimes, Van Buren helped people who supported Jackson's policies. He gave them government jobs. Van Buren also used a series of meetings to choose one presidential candidate for the party. If this process seems clear-cut, it was not at the time. During the election of 1824, for example, a single party had four separate candidates for president, one for each part of the country. Van Buren's system eventually gave rise to the national conventions that major U.S. parties use today to nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he saw that many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, states were giving more white males the right to vote. Women, and most African American men, were still largely prohibited from voting. Historian Joel Silby says, Van Buren wanted to bring the new voters into the Democratic Party. He decided to improve on the methods that other, smaller groups had used. Campaign events, speeches, and organized efforts to bring people to vote on Election Day. Silby explains that these efforts to persuade and energize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. In the election of 1840, Van Buren sought a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political techniques against him. Silby says the new opposition party, called the Whigs, used popular speeches and events to portray Van Buren as a failed president. Crowds shouted, "Matty Van is a used-up man." In other words, he no longer had any power or effect in government. Critics also made fun of Van Buren's fine-looking, even fussy clothes. They portrayed him as a rich, elite candidate. They compared him unfavorably to their candidate, a military hero named William Henry Harrison. Yet it was Van Buren who had come from a poor family, and Harrison from a wealthy one. Even so, Van Buren lost the election of 1840. 4 years later, Van Buren again sought the presidency. This time, even Andrew Jackson did not support him. Instead, Jackson backed a man who supported the seizure of Texas and expanding slavery, James Polk. But Van Buren did not permit those defeats to stop his political career. He ran again in the presidential election of 1848. This time, Van Buren withdrew from the Democratic Party he had helped build. He ran instead as the candidate of a new anti-slavery party called the Free Soilers. But even Van Buren's political skills could not persuade voters. He did not win a single state. After losing this final presidential election, Van Buren finally retired. He spent time with his children and grandchildren, traveled, and wrote about his life. At 79, he died of heart failure. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories and information from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.